Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Chronicles. We left off in this chapter 22. And just keep this in mind about what's happening now. We're going through this historical account in Chronicles. It's actually, we're dealing with one king in the north, one king in the south. We're dealing with the northern tribes referred to as Israel, the southern tribes referred to as Judah, so it can really get confusing. And what I think adds to the mix of confusion is, you know, some of these kings had the same name, and then some of them have names that are pronounced different, spelled different, and it just really can get confusing. But I still think there's a lot to be gleaned from these historical accounts, because Paul, I always go back to what Paul says in Corinthians, that everything that's written is for our instruction, is for our edification, is for our examples, for our reproof. And I think there's a lot that we can apply or make the application today in terms of, okay, what's the spiritual message that God is trying to get across here? Because I think it's more up to date or more relevant to tomorrow's newspaper. I really do, because I've said it over and over and over again all these years that everything's spiritual. And when you look at the historical accounts here and this never-ending, conflict between who's going to be king and who's going to be king in a mountain, and everybody trying to get their 15 minutes of fame. Well, we got to look at it from a spiritual perspective, and then I think it really becomes alive in terms of what God is trying to say to us. But when we get into this chapter 22, we're going to be dealing with this Ahaziah. But just back up, because we were talking about this other guy that was his father, Jehoram, and he was the son of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was a very godly king, and a king that was really committed to God. He made a lot of reforms on behalf of God. But man, he gets his son here, and he ends up marrying Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah. And that's just a terrible combination, because now this guy was so wicked, he killed off all of his brothers, even though he had the kingship, he had the throne. There's no doubt in my mind that it was his wife's influence that he did that. And then it was Elijah the prophet that basically wrote him a letter and said, man, you are really under a divine curse here because of all your wickedness. And he said that you're going to die a very, very painful death. That he was going to be struck with an illness in regards to his bowels, and that he was going to suffer immeasurably for 2 years until he finally died of this this ailment, this stomach disease or whatever it was. But that was quite a pronouncement of judgment. But I just really feel like this guy, he had a lot going for him in terms of the fact that he had such a godly father. But man, he really got turned around when he got involved with the wrong people. And now he has a son. If you back up to that verse, back up to that verse 18 of chapter 21, and we'll get into this chapter 22, because it said, so after all this, the Lord smote him in his bowels with an incurable sickness. Now it came about in the course of time, at the end of 2 years, that his bowels came out because of his sickness, and he died in great pain. And his people made no fire for him like the fire for his fathers. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years, and he departed with no one's regret, and they buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. See, look at the end that this guy comes to. I mean, he just totally self-destructed because of his wickedness. And he was so disliked that they just basically didn't give him any kind of honor, respect, even after he died. But I think it says a lot, because this guy, to get his 15 minutes of fame, you know, he did a lot of wicked deeds to hold on to that power, and it didn't last very long. He reigned like 7 years, and two of that he was sicker than a dog. But it was Solomon who said in Ecclesiastes that a good name is better than a good ointment, and a day of one's death is better than a day of one's birth. And it's the wise man that, you know, he said it's better to go into a house of mourning than to go into a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and a living takes it to heart. And I think Solomon really put his finger on, you know, this whole idea of death and dying, in a sense that, you know what, we really have to look at life through the spectrum cause of death. And if a person has a good name when they die, and I'm talking about a good name before God. I'm not talking about a good name before men. I'm talking about a good name before God. Well, Solomon said that that person, the day of his death is going to be better than the day of his birth, all right, because he has a good name before God. And then he says it's better to go into a funeral parlor and to just sit there, all alone and just look at that casket up there with the deceased person in it and just reflect on the fact, you know, that's going to be me in the very near future, and I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground, and then what? You know, we really have to ask ourselves some very serious questions and look at this guy. There's no way that the day of his death is better than the day of his birth, because he died a wretch, and that was the end of it. But now he has a son, and his son is going to take his place, but his son is absolutely no better than his father, basically, because of the influence of his mother. Like I said, she's the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. So beginning with verse 1 of chapter 22, then the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, king in his place. For the band of men who came with the Arabs to the camp had slain all the older sons. So Ahaziah, the son of Jeroboam, king of Judah, began to reign. And Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. I think that's a key there, because she not only influenced her son in all the wrong direction, but it was his father that she really steered in the wrong direction as well. And he says in verse 4, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, like the house of Ahab, for they were his counselors after the death of his father to his destruction. And I think that that sums it up pretty well, because, you know, he does evil, but in the end, it's just to his own destruction. And that'll apply to everyone, and especially the people in leadership, political leadership, religious leadership. I mean, they got a real judgment coming for them, because we are told in the Epistle of James that don't all of you become teachers or leaders, because you're going to incur a much stricter judgment as far as God is concerned. But look at this verse, like 2, 3, and 4, where it says, and Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. Now, anybody remember who Omri was? If you look at the chart that they made up there, it's on the right-hand side. He was actually a military leader, and he started a dynasty, and he was the father of Ahab. And this is what's kind of interesting in the book of Micah. It's been many, many years, I think, since we went through that book. But Micah was pronouncing a judgment upon these northern tribes because of all their wickedness. But he said this in Micah chapter 6. He says this, is there yet a man in the wicked house along with the treasures of wickedness and a short measure that is cursed? Can I justify wicked scales in a bag of deceptive weights? Now, Micah is talking about how in the northern tribes here, people became more and more dishonest. They were liars, cheaters, stealers, connivers. And look what we're dealing with today. I mean, we're just living among a bunch of people that are totally dishonest. And I've said it many, many times. You don't think so? Then leave your wallet or your credit card laying around anywhere and see if you don't panic, right? Well, there's no difference to these people up in the northern tribe before God just destroyed them. And he goes on to say in Micah chapter 6, he says this, for the rich men of the city are full of violence. Her residents speak lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Look at all these rich men in terms of politicians. They're synonymous with liars, aren't they? Oh, you can't believe anything they tell you. And then verse 13 says, also, I will make you sick, striking you down, desolating you because of your sins. You will eat, but you will not be satisfied. Your violence will be in your midst, and you will try to remove for safekeeping, but you will not preserve anything. And what you do preserve, I will give to the sword. I think that's kind of interesting, because he's saying a few things here. He says, you will eat but not be satisfied. Well, look at us. Well, our country is really pretty, tipping the scales in terms of people being obese and overweight. But what God is saying here, you can apply that to our economy. We just do not have two nickels to rub together. This is the kind of judgment that we're under. All right, sure, the rich are getting richer, but believe me, the poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is becoming non-existent. But who has the good graces to see, to understand? That's spiritual. That's God speaking to us. That's a curse that we're under because of all of our wickedness. And then he goes on to this. He said this in Micah. You will sow, but you will not reap. You will tread the olives, but will not anoint yourself with oil, and the grapes, but you will not drink wine. Now listen to this. It says this. The statutes of Omri, and all the works of the house of Ahab are observed, and in their devices you walk. Therefore I will give you up to destruction, and your inhabitants for derision, and you will bear the reproach of my people. Now this was a prophecy against the northern tribes of Israel, and God said, all these statutes of Omri you walk in. Now, I told you who Omri was, and he became basically the king of the northern tribes, right? But I will bring it up to where we live and breathe. And I will just rephrase this. The statutes of the government or the state and all the works of the house of the state are observed, and in their devices you walk. Therefore I will give you up for destruction and your inhabitants for derision. All right, now look at all these statutes that we are now walking in. That's what we observe rather than the statutes or the ordinances or the laws that God has put forth, right? So you see how when they're talking about here, verse 2, Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri, and he walked in the ways of the house of Ahab. Now, Omri, he was Ahab's father, and they started this dynasty that became synonymous with wickedness and evil. But today, we don't call it the statutes of Omri. We call it the statutes of the state. All these things that we're passing, these laws, kick God out of school, kick him out of everywhere, kick him out of our judicial system, everywhere you can because of the statutes of Omri. Just throw it out there. All this politically correct stuff, it's all an offense to God. It really is. And then he says this in verse 5 of 2 Chronicles chapter 22. He also walked according to their counsel and went with Jehoram, the son of Ahab, the king of Israel, to wage war against Hazael, the king of Aram, at Ramoth-Gilead. But the Arameans wounded Joram, so he returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which they had inflicted on him at Ramah. And when he fought against Hazael, king of Aram, and Hazael, the son of Jeroram, king of Judah, went down to see Jeroram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was sick. Now the destruction of Ahaziah was from God, and that he went to Jeroram. For when he came, he went out with Jeroboam against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab. Now, I know that sounds kind of confusing, but here's the thing. If you look on the chart that I made, you see a situation where Jehu is the one who's now going to become king. But if we go back to the first book of Kings, we read all about Elijah and his situation with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah and how he withstood them. And I think it's kind of significant because in this particular situation, you know, that was when he went up to this Mount Carmel, of course, and he had this conflict with all these false prophets and had them all killed. And then he went running scared to Jezebel. And then he goes all the way down to Mount Horeb, way down there in the south. And that's when he went into a cave, and that's when God addressed him was that first there was just a tremendous wind when Elijah was in this cave, and it was just rending the rocks, and you know this wind was more powerful than any hurricane because it was just things were just flying all over the place. And then it says that the Lord wasn't in the wind, and then it says there was just tremendous earthquake. Everything was shaken on this mountain, but the Lord wasn't in the mountain. And then it was fire just consuming this mountain, and it says the Lord wasn't in this fire. But then there was a still small voice. There was this whisper, and then that's when Elijah put his mantle around his face and he walked out, and that's where God spoke to him. But yeah, I think it's kind of interesting what God said to him when he spoke to Elijah, because Elijah was basically feeling, well, I'm the only one left here. I don't know what the point is of me even being around here. But this is what it says after God is speaking to him on this mountain. It says that when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave and began behold, the voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Then he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." The Lord said to him, "Go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram." Now listen to this. "And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about, the one who escaped from the sword of Hazael, Jehu, shall put to death, and the one who escaped from the sword of Jehu, Elisha, shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Now here's the thing. This is what God told Elijah to do. Go anoint Jehu over the northern tribe of Israel, and I'm going to use Jehu to kill off the entire household of Ahab because of all their wickedness. All right, so when we're reading here, this doesn't give us any information at all, hardly, when they read in 2 Chronicles chapter 22, when it just simply says in that verse 7, "Now the destruction of Ahaziah was from God, and that he went to Joram. For when he came, he went out with Joram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab." And we read about that situation where in Kings, because these kings had been in basically cahoots in terms of their attempts to get rid of the Syrians out of their land, Joram, all right, he was wounded in this battle, but then Ahaziah goes up to visit him and at Jezreel, and that's when Jehu goes over there and he pulls back his bow and he, you know, lets it fly and kills Jehoram, and then he has Ahaziah killed as well. And then Jehu goes forth and he destroys all the household of Ahab. He had 70 sons. Ahab had 70 sons, and he had all these guys' heads decapitated and put in two piles, you know, at the front of the gate of the city. But this was a judgment from God, because God said, because of this man and this woman's wickedness, I'm going to destroy this whole entire dynasty. It started with Omri, all right? And now God has completely destroyed him. And that was when Jehu had all these people killed, and that's when he went into the city there, and that's when Jezebel painted up herself, and I guess her idea was, well, okay, I'll just seduce this Jehu because I could just wrap any man around my finger, and I'll just still maintain my position of power. And then Jehu goes into the city, and she's up there in a tower, and he says to the eunuchs up there, "Who's with me?" And he says, "Throw her down." So they threw her out the window. She goes bouncing on a concrete, and Jehu tramples this woman with his horse. And that's when he just goes in to have lunch, and that's when the dogs came and devoured this woman's body, all except for her hands and her feet. I think it says a lot, because that was a prediction by Elijah himself. So that's how God basically did away with this dynasty. But I think, to me, the instruction is pretty sobering when God, I think, is really trying to instill in us, even today. Look, bad company corrupts good morals. And we could come from a good household and end up totally shipwrecked if we start hanging around with the wrong people. That's all there is to it. I mean, history is just strewn with the wreckage of people who have done just that. They come from households that are very devoted to God, even ministers for God, and you'll find because their offspring get involved with the wrong people that they end up being totally shipwrecked. Well, that's what you see with this household of Ahab. But then he says this in this verse 8, "And it came about when Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab, he found the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah, his brothers, ministering to Ahaziah, and he slew them. And he also sought Ahaziah, and they caught him while he was hiding in Samaria. And they brought him to Jehu, and he put him to death and buried him there. For they said, 'He is the son of Jehoshaphat, who sought the Lord with all of his heart.' So there was no one of the house of Ahaziah to retain the power of the kingdom. And when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal offspring of the house of Judah. But Jehoshaphat, the king's daughter, took Ash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So Jehoshaphat, the daughter of the king Jehoram, the wife of Jehoiada, the priest, for she was the sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah so that she would not put him to death. He was hidden with them in the house of God 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. And now this woman, we read very clearly that what she does is she has been very instrumental in even introducing Baal worship in the southern kingdom. Because remember, it all started up there, up in the north, when we're talking about how Jezebel introduced so much of this Baal worship up north. Then it crept down, because of those alliances that were made, into Judah, into the southern tribes, that people began to worship Baal. Now, here's the thing. I teach a class on Tuesday morning, and we were going through the book of Numbers, and we were dealing with this Numbers chapter 25, when we're dealing with this Baal, and we read about what happened to Israel just before they get into the Promised Land. There's a situation there because of the council of Balaam, and when he told Balak, who was the king of Moab, and he told the Midianites that Balaam said, I can't curse these people because God won't let me, but here's the way you can get them to curse themselves. He says, get all your really, really good-looking women and send them over there all dolled up, man, in their most seductive-looking dresses and all their makeup and the war paint, whatever, and get them over there, and these guys are really going to flip for these women, and then get these women to get these guys involved in worshiping your gods. And it was Baal that they were worshiping. And this is what it says in Numbers chapter 25. It says, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. So when we're talking about this Baal, this was a Canaanite deity. And it was prevalent all over Cana before Israel got into the land. And God gave very specific instructions. When you go into that land, you destroy every vestige of every type of idol and idol worship and the Baal worship and all this. Well, they didn't do a thorough job. And this was a situation where this whole Baal worship began to really take hold, especially in the north. All right. But here's what I think people have to understand. As God said, the very first time that these people got involved with Baal worship, it says, and the people joined themselves to Baal of Peor. This is what it says. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now, in the class that I was teaching the other morning, I was asking people, what does it mean to join yourself to Baal of Peor? What does that mean?
Spiritual adultery.
Yes, I always go back to what God had basically said in Corinthians in regards to this whole concept of joining ourselves to any god but the Lord, because I've said this many, many times over the years. This is probably the most profound thing I've ever read in the Bible, where Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them a members of a prostitute? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins, J-O-I-N-S, the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says, and God says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. And this is what God is saying very graphically and very clearly, that this whole concept of a husband and wife, this marriage union, this sexual union between a husband and wife, that's male and female, right? That is a reflection of the one spirit union between God and the individual soul, between God and his bride Israel, or Jesus and his church, or Jesus and his bride. All right, that's a mystery that Paul talks about in Ephesians chapter 5. And so God is a jealous God. And when people begin to worship other gods, it's the same thing as adultery, all right, but it's spiritual adultery, and God is a jealous God, and he won't tolerate a rival. So if you put all this together about these people getting involved with this Baal worship, we have to see what God is really saying. And when these people got involved in sacrificing to Baal or sacrificing to other gods, who were they really sacrificing to?
Demons.
I mean, the Bible makes it abundantly clear what people really get into when they start worshiping false gods. Because this is what it says in Deuteronomy in regards to that very situation of Baal Peor. He says this, Deuteronomy chapter 32, it says, but Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. Now, Jeshurun, I've said before a number of times, it was a name of endearment. It was basically a nickname that God called Israel, and it was an affectionate title for Israel. But it says, this is what it says in Deuteronomy, but Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw this and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. Now, this is what God is saying. Through Moses, these people, when they got involved with worshiping other gods, they were really sacrificing to demons. And people say, well, that's just the Old Testament, man. What is that going to do with anything? But this is what Paul says in the New Testament. He says the exact same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Since there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink of the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Now, that's pretty straightforward. Do people realize what they're getting into when they get into all these different false religions and they start worshiping these other gods? And, you know, people say, well, you are just an intolerant bigot. And I say, not me. I didn't write this. I didn't write one word of it, man. This is the way God feels on this subject, and this is the way he feels on this matter. That if we could profess to believe in Jesus Christ, but then we end up, let's just say, going to a fortune teller, going to a seance, going to any number of things where we are really trafficking with demons, then we are being unfaithful spiritually. We're sacrificing to demons, and God won't tolerate that. But you look at the situation where how these people got involved with this, and then we're reading all about what this Athaliah, and we read all about Jezebel, and how they just brought down the nation with all of this. And, you know, if you really analyze it and really step back and look at what's happened there, you know, historically speaking, you can see even these people here in Moses' day, when they got involved with these Moabite women through the Council of Balaam, these men were just duped because of the influence of the women who seduced them into this worshiping of this false god. But we are also given a kind of a key in that Deuteronomy where it says that Jeshurun grew fat and he grew thick and sleek. I think that almost gives us a little clue of where they really made their downfall as well. Because if you read that situation in Numbers, these people are now, they've come out of the desert after 40 years and now they're camped right across from Jericho at Shittim. But when they entered this land here, they were victorious against these kings on this side, and then they began to really enjoy the land on this side. And for 40 years, led pretty much of an austere life, but now they're prosperous over here. Now they really are, you know, their diet is really improved in terms of its variety. And you see a situation where it says right there in Deuteronomy, it says this, but Jeshurun grew fat and thick. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. And how many times have I said in Deuteronomy chapter 6, Deuteronomy chapter 8, God warns his people saying, listen, when you get into this land I'm giving you and all this stuff that you get that you haven't worked for, I don't care whether it's the cisterns or the wells or if it's the crops or the flocks and the herds and all your olive groves and peaches and all this stuff. He said, when you get all that stuff, he said, and your bellies are full, he said, then beware, or watch yourself, because then you'll forget the Lord your God. Now, who can remember? Because I've said this many times going through this. God gave the antidote in Deuteronomy chapter 6, whereas he said, if we're prosperous, I think that's when we're in our most dangerous position spiritually, when we're prosperous. Because then, when our bellies are full, we can easily forget God just exactly the way these people did. But God gave the antidote in Deuteronomy chapter 6. He said, the only way that you are going to remember me when you are prosperous is what?
Write the right word on your... on your post, put on your...
Yeah, he says, you got to read my words, you got to study my words, you got to meditate upon my words, you got to have my scripture verses all around your house, you got to talk about me when you wake up, when you walk along the way, and when you're having a meal, and when you go to bed at night. That's the only way that we are not going to forget God. But now look at what's happened to our nation. We don't have any idea what it is, all right, to suffer from starvation and malnutrition and this type of thing, right? But that's been our downfall, because we became just like what it says here about Israel. Israel grew fat and kick. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. In other words, what does that mean? Fat, thick, and sleek. You know, you just have an easy, comfortable life, and this is where you can forget God, right? And then he forsook God, who made him, and scorned the rock of his salvation. Have we scorned the rock of our salvation? Look what we've done to him in our schools. Have we scorned him there? We just said, can't stomach the thought of God in our schools anymore. We don't want anybody reading the Bible or talking about God or praying to God or anything like that, any kind of religious paraphernalia. And they took God, they threw him on his ear. That was just done in a total contempt. It was because we became prosperous. Who needs God, you know? We don't need him. And I'll tell you, we can always blame it on Madeline Marie O'Hare and all her phony cronies who got God thrown out of school. But I would tell you this. If this country was not apathetic about that, the day that they got God thrown out of school, this nation did nothing but just yawn, belch, pass gas, roll over and go back to sleep. That's all it did, man. That's all it did. The fact that we were just apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent, and then evil begins to take over more and more and more. That's the progression. It's an evolution. If you really look at it, look where we're at today. All right? We were once a nation that honored God, that respected God, that basically, as a nation, as a whole, it doesn't mean everybody in the nation, but as a whole, we try to obey God, follow God, uphold him and his laws. But more and more, people who try to take a stand for God and for his moral laws and for Jesus Christ, they are becoming more and more marginalized and more and more vilified. And what's the buzzword they'd like to throw at you?
You're a bigot.
You're hateful, you're intolerant, you're a homophobic, you're dangerous, you're a fanatic. Right now, it's just verbal. But now, and I don't care what evil it is, I don't care what, just going online, you know, abortion or whatever. Now that we embraced it, now we're vilifying people who oppose it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, once we get to that point, where does it go after vilifying people? What's the next step?
Persecution, throw them in jail,
okay.
Take away their livelihood.
Look at the churches, right? Any church now who's going to stand up and say, you know what, this is what God said in this issue, and we really need to repent of the sin, or we're not going to see heaven. Now what's going to happen to that church?
Status taken away.
Tax-exempt status. Well, now you're preaching hate. Now we're going to take away your tax-exempt status. And then what happens after that?
They could even prosecute them under civil rights laws too, for being hate crimes.
Yes, because if you continue to try to uphold God's moral standards, then after they take away your tax exempt status, and then you continue to try to uphold God's moral laws in the face of the statutes of Omri, then they're going to fine you. Mm-hmm. And then if you continue to preach against the statutes of Omri, then they're going to imprison you. Mm-hmm. And then, if you continue to do it, they're going to execute you. And people say, that would never happen here, never happen, never. And I'm saying, you know what? You have no idea what history is like. And you don't have to go back that far. You really do not have to go back that far in history. You don't even have to go back 100 years, all right? Just go back and look under these regimes, these dictatorships, these fascists, all right? And you will see this is exactly what happened. And it all started happening with this apathy and indifference to God and the things of God, and then it leads to this hell on earth. It really does, and it's coming here. It's coming here, and that's why I think it's kind of significant. Well, we're talking about this Baal of Peor, and how do these people start worshiping this Baal? But then, you got to go back how they first got involved with this Baal. It was the Council of Balaam, and his council was basically this. And Jesus Christ even mentions this Balaam. And I, in my class I've been teaching on Tuesday, I've been talking about this Balaam, because there's more written about this Balaam than virtually every apostle except the Apostle Paul. And people don't even know who this Balaam is, right? Some people say Balaam. Don't get hung up on how the pronunciation of his name. But this is what Jesus Christ said about this guy. And it was the last thing mentioned about this Balaam, because he was a Gentile prophet. He was a true prophet of God. But he didn't get the reward that he wanted so desperately from the king of Moab, because he couldn't curse Israel. But then he comes up with a plan. He calls the king of Moab along with the Midianite leaders. And he says, look, I can't curse these people, but this is what you do. You get all your best-looking women, man, and you get them over there to the Israelite camp, and you have these women invite all these men over to your love feast, and then you seduce these men, and then you get these men to start offering sacrifices to their God. And then when they do that, Balaam said they're going to bring a curse on their own head. Now, that was a prophet of God who gave that advice, and it was Jesus Christ who really got into the face of this church of Pergamum, because he said this, and to the angel of the church of Pergamum write, the one who has the sharp two-edged sword says this, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. Now, he says that twice. In Pergamum, they had this huge temple to Zeus, and this was where people would sacrifice to their god, Zeus. But Jesus is saying, this is where Satan dwells, and the people are really offering up sacrifice to Satan. And Jesus said this in this Revelation chapter 2 in regards to this church of Pergamum. He says, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness. Now, tradition tells us that in Pergamum, Antipas was brought before this court, this tribunal, and they were trying to get him to renounce his faith in Jesus Christ. And then he would not do it. And then one of the judges stood up and says, Antipas, don't you realize that the whole world is against you? And then Antipas stood up and said, then I'm against the whole world. And you can even read this on the internet. Tradition says that he took this Antipas and he took him outside and they put him inside of a brass, hollowed out brass bowl. And then they lit a fire under him and they roasted him to death. And Jesus makes mention of this guy. He says, he didn't deny my faith, even the days of Antipas, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. And he says this, but I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold to the teaching of Balaam, and who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. Now, this is what Balaam was counseling Balak, right? Believe it or not. But it was Jesus Christ who said, he epitomized this when he said, no man can serve two masters. You're either going to love one or hate the other, or cleave to one and despise the other. He says you cannot serve God and what?
Mammon.
Mammon, money, material things. You see, this is what Balaam tried to do. He tried to do a two-step. He wanted to be faithful to God. He wanted to be obedient to God. He wanted to be God's prophet. But the love of money prompted him to try to find some way that he could get this reward, he could get this money, he could get this prestige. And the only way he can come up with it is saying, look, I can't curse these people, but I'll tell you what, you can get them to curse themselves. Just get them involved with these women. And because why? Balaam knew, hey man, get your best looking women over there, because these men are just going to fall like dumb ox. And I was bringing this out the other night. The other day in my teaching, because I think it's so important that people realize this. And if you look through scriptures, you can see it. It really is phenomenal, the power of the woman has over a man when it comes to influencing him for good or for evil. You know what? We're talking about this Baal that this woman and basically her mother introduced in the northern kingdom, and this Athaliah has now introduced in the southern kingdom. And what is this Baal all about? Because people can read this and they just feel like, well, you know, That was way back then. We don't have gods like that today, but we most certainly do. But you got to ask, okay, now who are these people really sacrificing to? You get these things like voodoo or Santeria, and they get into all these different blood sacrifices and these animal sacrifices, and then you Satanism, human sacrifice, all of this kind of stuff. Do people realize what they're dealing with here? Right? Do they really see what's happening here? But now, apply it to our country, and I'll go ahead and close, because I'm not going to try to get into this next chapter until, you know, because we're going to be dealing with this stallion. I want to devote a little bit more time to it, but remember what God said, or basically it was Samuel said to Saul when Saul disobeyed God. Samuel said to him, hey, rebellion is as a sin of what?
Witchcraft.
And stubbornness is as a sin of what?
Idolatry.
Now, I'm going to repeat that, and I'm going to apply it to our country. Rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as a sin of idolatry. Now, idolatry could be the same thing as what worshiping Baal, right? Or any of these false gods, and what you're really worshiping is demons. So, if we are rebellious towards God when it comes to His moral laws, guess what we've done? We've actually opened ourselves up for demonic influence.
Oh, absolutely.
We've opened it, and now we're going to be stubborn. Look at the sins that we're really stubborn about. We will die before we give up these sins because we love our sin. The sins of murdering unborn children, or the sins of homosexuality, the sins of gay marriage. Just go down the line. Lying, cheating, stealing, conniving, all these things. Look at pornography. We'll die before we give that sin up. And what did Jesus Christ say about it? Adultery. He said, it is written, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you, if a man even looks at a woman in order to lust after her in his heart, he's committed adultery. Now look at all the guys, not just in this country, but around the world. It's a man's weakness because it's the power, the influence of a woman. And as a husband may say, well, you know what, I'm never unfaithful to my wife, but if we are addicted to pornography, guess what? We become serial adulterers. Are we going to give that sin up, pornography? Just throw it out there. Do you think we will ever give that sin up?
At a national level, no.
No, that's what I'm driving at. So when you look at these sins that we're very stubborn on, then what does that do? It opens up this country for demonic influence. And we got to the point now where we're promoting our sins and we're saying that good is evil and evil is good, that right is wrong and wrong is right, that truth is false and falsehood is truth. Okay, we're substituting bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. All right, light for darkness and darkness for light. That's where we're at. So when we get to that point, believe me, the devils just have a heyday and there's no hope for us. There really isn't. Right? Because we love our sin and we're not going to part with it. That's how stubborn we are. But like I said, that's what we're talking about, this influence that crept down in there because of Baal worship.